On 88.1 WIPR, I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Maryland Morning. It's sine die today. The Maryland General Assembly is slated to close up shop for the year tonight. This morning, WIPR's Rachel Bay joins us from Annapolis with an overview of what's been accomplished so far and what's likely to get done in the final hours. And in another in our continuing series of conversations as we approach the one-year anniversary of the violence that coursed through Baltimore last April, Diane Bell McCoy, the executive director and CEO of Associated Black Charities, and Strong City Baltimore's CEO, Karen Stokes, join me to talk about what neighborhood and neighbors can do to help Charm City heal. Plus, WIPR's Sheila Cass speaks with Ambassador and former Middle East envoy Dennis Ross in advance of his appearance on the Baltimore Speaker Series, and theater critic J. Wynn Russick reviews The Flick at the Signature Theater. Maryland Morning starts right after the news.
I'm producer Rob Sivak. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Morning. It's Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Tom Hall. Today is Sine Die, or Sine Die, as it's come to be pronounced, in the Maryland General Assembly. It's Latin for without a day for resumption of meetings to take place. Of course, it's no big mystery when the 2017 Maryland General Assembly will convene in January, but there are a few bills whose fate remains uncertain as legislators enter into the final day and night of this year's session. WIPR's Annapolis reporter Rachel Bay was in Annapolis over the weekend keeping an eye on some last-minute negotiations. She's on the line from the State House this morning with her perspective on how things are likely to shake out between now and midnight tonight. Morning, Rachel. How you doing?
Hey, good morning. I'm good. How are you doing?
Doing fine. So let's start with some things that appear to be issues that have reached some agreement. There's a big criminal justice reform push, some legislation around that. What's the status of that as we speak?
Well, so that legislation seems to have reached some sort of accord. It still is waiting for final votes in both houses of the chamber, in both houses of the General Assembly today. At some point, but it looks like we have a compromise measure that no one is totally thrilled with, but everyone is backing.
I mean, among other things, it has to do with drug offenders being put into treatment instead of into prison. There are some mandatory minimum sentencing that gets thrown to the wayside. It looks like this is generally considered good news and a victory for people interested in criminal justice reform.
Yeah, that's right. And one of the big things about this that advocates have been pushing is that it's not only expected to help reduce the prison population, get some of these low-level drug offenders serving less time or put them into treatment as opposed to into prison, but it's also supposed to save the state money. How much money remains to be seen. It just depends on what specifics the bill has in its final form. But some money is more than likely.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the idea was that if fewer people are in prison, it costs less money to run the prisons. Therefore, you can spend that money on substance abuse treatment and that sort of thing. They're sort of just putting it from one pocket to another, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right, yes.
So let's talk about income taxes. There are a couple of different proposals in the House and the Senate for a new income tax plan. At this point, it seems, look particularly clear as to which one of those two will prevail. What's your guess on that?
Well, it's hard. I have a rule of not trying to make any predictions about what happens on Sine Die because all bets are sort of off at a certain point. But right now, it looks like the consensus measure includes income tax cuts or tax cuts for the lower income classes, but not for people who are earning more than $150,000. That's something that the Senate has passed, but the House it doesn't seem too keen on.
Yeah, if I understand it correctly, the House wants to limit it to people who are middle and low income taxpayers. The Senate wants to have the income tax reductions for that class as well as people making over $150,000 in small businesses in particular. I guess they're concerned about trying to make Maryland as appealing as possible for business owners.
Exactly. Yeah, that's right.
How about police reform, the LEOBR, the Law Enforcement Officers Bill of Rights? It's gotten a lot of attention this session, but it still, at this point, has not been settled. What's the hang-up there?
Well, so the hang-up is really the role that civilians will play in disciplinary decisions. These are administrative disciplinary review boards that police officers face when they deal when they have some sort of disciplinary misconduct. And one chamber is really eager to give civilians a vote on those review boards, but that seems to be in conflict.
Because at this point, I guess both chambers agree that civilians should be on the review board, but then there's a disagreement about whether or not they should actually have a vote when it comes to examining issues of police misconduct. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, there is also some conflict over even whether civilians should be on the boards, but at this point, it looks like that's more or less settled. The major issue is going to be whether they are able to have a vote. And this is something that law enforcement has been fighting pretty heavily. They say it's pretty standard practice to have kind of, as they put it, like a jury of their peers, of other fellow law enforcement officers who really understand the way the job works. And they argue that civilians won't necessarily have that perspective. Of course, especially given the tension that Baltimore specifically has seen between law enforcement and a lot of the communities that they serve, this civilian on the review board has been considered a pretty important component of this package.
Sure. I mean, perhaps of all of the pieces of legislation that have been considered in these last 90 days, this LEOBR, the Law Enforcement Officers Bill of Rights, perhaps is the one that's received the most attention, given the fact that the violence that occurred last April, sprang out of an incident of alleged police misconduct. So it seemed, just a real stinging disappointment to the Baltimore delegation, to the mayor, to Stephanie Rawlings Blake, and to others who have advocated so strongly for strengthening that bill and revising it and tweaking it in a way that is good for both law enforcement and civilians. That would be a sort of a crushing blow for those folks, wouldn't it? If they can't get this thing done.
Yeah, it really would. This has been considered kind of a priority legislation from the leadership, and this actually came out of a bipartisan group of stakeholders from various different parts of the state. You had law enforcement representatives on this board. You had members of both parties within the General Assembly, and you had judges. You had a lot of different stakeholders, and all coming together. And so it would be kind of a big blow to all those people who put in all that work as well to not see this come to fruition.
Rachel Bay is WIPR's Annapolis reporter. She joins us this morning from Annapolis here on Sine Die, the last day of the 90-day session of the Maryland General Assembly. On 88.1 WIPR, it's Maryland Morning, and I'm Tom Hall. Rachel, there's a bill called Noah's Law. It's named after a Montgomery County police officer, Noah Leota, who was killed by an alleged drunk driver, and it has to do with whether or not people convicted of drunk driving should be forced to have an ignition lock on their cars, which would disable the car, make the driver unable to operate the vehicle if the person is inebriated. Where does that stand?
So this bill is also in flux, in dispute. There was a conference committee held for this bill. There's consensus that the ignition interlock devices should be required. That's not really up for debate. The part that's up for debate is whether there should also be stiffer penalties for people who are convicted of drunken driving. And this is something that advocates for the bill actually are really wary of, because they feel like it weakens the law and makes it less likely to pass.
Back to making the state more conducive for business. The Senate passed a $37.5 million tax break for Northrop Grumman, whose office and establishment is down there by the airport. But evidently, this tax break faces some pretty long odds in the House. What's your prediction there? What's the status of that as we speak this morning?
Yeah, you know, I'm not so sure about this one. This is something that the governor had requested, actually, technically, that the Department of Commerce had requested, and basically it's $37.5 million over 5 years in exchange for Northrop Grumman maintaining 10,000 employees in the state and spending $100 million in capital. And, you know, advocates for this include both Democrats and Republicans, and so do the opponents. So it does face pretty tough odds in the House, though, so we'll see. But it's not looking great.
And we should mention that with all of these bills, if nothing happens, if the House and Senate can't come to an agreement on the final form of a bill, it doesn't come for a vote and it just dies, right? It has the possibility of being revived next session, but no possibility of anything happening at this juncture, at this point in the session.
Yeah, I mean, they have a hard deadline of midnight tonight, and really, and this is full disclosure, my first time covering the session, but what I've been told is that everything comes to a standstill at midnight. That you know, whatever is going on, whatever they're working on, everything kind of just stops. And if they haven't passed the bill, they haven't passed the bill, and they'll have to wait until next year, barring some sort of the governor calling a special session to deal with it.
Right, and it's not beyond a possibility that sine die could be continued and, you know, rescheduled for tomorrow, although that almost never happens, right?
Yeah, no, I mean, there are all sorts of tricks that they can do with the calendar. In fact, that's how they will function today. We'll probably see legislative day-wise, we'll probably see three different calendar days almost appear today on the agenda, which is a very confusing mechanism. But yeah, they usually don't push actually the end of session beyond midnight on sine die.
I wonder, we just have a few seconds left here, Rachel. I mean, I wonder if you think that the red line decision by Governor Hogan to scuttle plans to build a red line in Baltimore has sort of loomed large over this year's session. I mean, there were some vetoes, including a veto of the bill that requires the governor to do a transportation scoring bill, for example. Did the red line decision sort of play into a lot of other things and these other veto overrides?
It definitely played into that particular veto override. Both houses overrode that late last week. And it also played into this bill that created an MTA board, advisory board of riders and community members. Otherwise, it kind of created this tension between the Democratic leaders in the General Assembly and the governor, who's a Republican.
All right, Rachel Bay is WIPR's State House reporter and in for a very busy day. Rachel, I appreciate the time, and we'll talk to you soon. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Rachel Bay is WIPR's State House reporter. Stay tuned to WIPR for complete coverage of the Maryland General Assembly with more from Rachel, as well as conversations about the General Assembly here on Maryland Morning and on Midday with Sheila Cass. Lots more ahead on Maryland Morning. Coming up after a break for the news, conversation about the state of Baltimore almost a year after the violence of last spring with Karen Stokes of the neighborhood advocacy organization Strong City Baltimore and Diane Bell McCoy of Associated Black Charities. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. Mr. Sterner, back to you, sir.
Thanks, Tom. You're listening to the Maryland Morning Podcast, a service of your public radio, WYPR, in Baltimore. Find more podcasts at WYPR.org and tell us what you think by email, mdmorning@WYPR.org. Now, back to the podcast.
Welcome back. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. 2 weeks from Wednesday, the day after the primary election that will help set the table to decide, among other things, who our next mayor will be, Baltimore will mark the one-year anniversary of the violence and uprising that erupted after the funeral of Freddie Gray, who, as you know, died in police custody. We're having a series of conversations leading up to that anniversary about the state of our city before and since that cataclysmic week that began on April 27th last year. Now we turn to two women who are at the forefront of organizing and affecting the kind of change that so many people think is long overdue in a city that, like many cities in the United States, has tremendous inequality drawn along racial and economic lines. Karen Stokes is the CEO of Strong City Baltimore, an organization that aspires to empower and inform community organizers, educators, and people across Baltimore's nearly 300 neighborhoods. Diane Bell McCoy is the president and CEO of Associated Black Charities, which advocates on public policy and targets philanthropy to make middle and low-income communities healthier and more prosperous. Good morning and welcome to you both.
Good morning. Good morning. Thank you.
So, Diane Bell-McCoy, there have been no shortage of panels and symposiums and reports and political conversations about the problems of inequality and the problems that underlie the unrest from last year. Everybody from arts organizations to policy wonks. You're going to be leading another panel. We're going to talk about that in a minute at a thing called the Neighborhood Institute, which takes place on Saturday. You are very close to the ground about what's going on in this town. What, in your estimation, has happened in this last year? Has the ball been moved forward substantially since April 27th last year?
I think the ball's been put in play. That's what I would say. The ball's been put in play. Has it been moved substantially? I don't think that's true. And I think what happens after this will be up to all of us in Baltimore from every walk of life, whether or not we can continue to move it forward, because it's a very complicated process to change these kind of wealth disparities in our city, in many cities.
And has the conversation changed? I mean, with the ball in play now, are we speaking about this? Are we considering this, ruminating on it in a different way than we were before the violence?
I think those organizations that, I think there are different organizations looking at it differently. And I think everyone is using their lens to look at it differently. I think the challenge will be, how do we move the ball forward? Do we find a way with a collective set of lens to look at the issue? Because looking at it from each one of our individual lens is not going to take us to a collective that's going to benefit all of us in a greater way. And I think it requires both work on the ground and certainly the work that Strong Cities is doing in terms of making a difference with a host of other organizations, Leaders for a Beautiful Struggle, organizing, advocacy. But it's going to take a difference by looking at policies. And how do we have a different set of policies? How do we stop policies from being promulgated the way they are? How do we pay attention to the impact, long-term impact of structural racism? So it's a very multi-level effort that's going to have to take place. And it's going to include our business community. Many of them have stepped up already. A number of them are still continuing, because everybody's clear that if we don't figure this out now, it really does hurt all of us in a very collective way. And we're going to have some tough conversations around race, tough conversations around those wealth disparities. And that's a little difficult for us as a city and many cities. But for Baltimore, I think it's a little bit of a challenge in terms of understanding what we had to see happen that for many people didn't know was existing in our city.
Absolutely. And Karen Stokes, part of the Neighborhood Institute that's going to take place on Saturday, is designed to have that conversation, to ask those tough questions and to help people start coming up with answers. This is the ninth year that you've done it. Tell us what's involved in this, who you're going to bring together, what kinds of stuff you're going to talk about.
We have it at the Baltimore Design School, which is a wonderful example, actually, of community-based development. And the people who come together in this particular venue are actual community residents. This is very grassroots. We expect about 300 neighborhood leaders, people who their other folks are cultivating as potential neighborhood leaders. They are folks who are community activists, people who care about their neighborhoods. Most people in Baltimore, regardless of where you go, people do deeply care about where they live. What we're trying to do is give people some hands-on tools to make a difference. How do they make those changes? And what's unique about this, I believe, is that we're bringing together all these various neighborhood activists, from people who may live in the Oliver community or in Park Heights, Roland Park, South Baltimore, York Road corridor. And this is an opportunity for leaders to talk to each other as well. So they're going to be, we have 27 workshops planned. There will be over 50 presenters. Many of our presenters are people who actually do the work themselves out in the community. And we have an opportunity for people both to hear. All of our workshops are about an hour long, and we provide resources across the board for anything that any neighborhood organization, association might need, you probably can find at this institute.
It's a one-stop shopping kind
of
thing. It is.
That's how we envision it.
Yeah. And Diane Bell-McCoy, you're going to be kicking this off on Saturday with a panel talking about building community wealth. What do we mean by community wealth? And is community wealth building a matter of money, a matter of dollars, or does that definition extend to other ways of being wealthy?
I think it's much more encompassing than dollars. Certainly community wealth is a big part of that, is changing the dollar outcome. But I think it's also about the wealth that we have, as Karen just talked about, even in terms of our citizens. And we don't often think about that as part of community wealth, but making sure that we lift up that kind of leadership that's a part of our neighborhoods and building community wealth. But when you think about community wealth, you think about some things that historically we haven't always accepted that we're a part of building community wealth, including resident-led businesses in terms of that kind of engagement. Even as we think about community wealth from standpoint of our anchor institutions making a difference of lending their power, their wealth in terms of helping small businesses be able to get more business and doing more in that community, giving a leg up. It's about housing, but it's also about the pathway to that. It's about retaining that. Community wealth is a collective in terms of how do we increase the economic outcomes in this city. And I am excited about the panel. I'm excited about Strong Cities in terms of this opportunity to have this kind of dialogue. And sometimes I think the dialogue will also be tough to have in terms of what I define as community, what I believe are my assets, which versus another neighborhood believes are their assets. But that's the space that we can have that kind of conversation, and that becomes an important way to have the conversation about building community wealth.
Diane Bell McCoy is the president and CEO of Associated Black Charities. Karen Stokes is the CEO of Strong City Baltimore. The Neighborhood Institute will take place on Saturday on 88.1 WIPR. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. So Karen Stokes, your organization began after the last set of riots we had.
Indeed.
In 1968.
Yes.
At that time, it was called the Greater Homewood Neighborhood Association. You changed it just a year or so ago to Strong City. I wonder, we have something like 278 separate neighborhoods in the city of Baltimore. And people often point to that with pride, and we're a city of these, you know, individual communities. But I wonder, given the fact that, you know, a kid growing up or being born in Harlem Park has a life expectancy that's 20 years shorter than the kid being born in Roland Park, is it to our advantage? Is it advisable for us to be thinking about these individual enclaves, these individual groups of neighbors, rather than thinking about the city as a whole?
Well, I think we do both, and that is partly why we changed our name, because we have been citywide really for the, you know, for really the past decade. I think what Diane mentioned earlier about the collective is really important. Neighborhoods are great because they have a certain kind of sense, you know, one neighborhood to another, there's a difference. Like, you know, the Barclay neighborhood is clearly very different in some ways in Bolton Hill, both in terms of the housing structures, and there's a lot of differences about it. But what is also clear that neighborhood boundaries are in many ways often irrelevant. Crime doesn't stop at one boundary. We have to actually work across these neighborhoods. And the work of my organization as an intermediary has always been, we have community associations and neighborhood associations. What we see is, how do we connect those folks along, you know, with each other? So you drive up Calvert Street as an example, and I know that community is really looking about traffic calming. Well, it affects lots of neighborhoods all along the way. When a new library comes in, you know, it may affect four or five different neighborhoods. So you really need to provide some training and help for neighborhood leaders to figure out, how do we build a coalition? We're a lot more powerful when we are organized as a community. So number one, this institute's about really talking about power and talking about the fact that if you're not organized, if you don't have your block organized and your neighborhood organized, you will be overlooked. But then in addition to that, how do you get organized across those neighborhood boundaries? And we create coalitions, and we see those very effectively happening, whether it's the No Boundaries Coalition over in West Baltimore, the York Road Partnership. There's coalitions that can also be useful.
One of the things that I like about the work of Strong Cities, and I know this is tough space as well for so many of us, is that this year there is a conversation in terms of about the racial inequities. So although, yeah, we do have lots of ways of coming together and finding out ways to create a collective, there is an unevenness in terms of even capacity by virtue of a Sandtown versus a Roland Park. That's just a reality. In terms of, by accepting that reality, by putting that reality on the table and beginning to understand what that means from a structural standpoint of barriers, I think that's the way we will actually be able to move the agenda forward, because it's not ignoring the differences, it's celebrating the things we have in common, but it's also acknowledging that we've got structural barriers that come from the history of our city that has created the disparities, particularly around race and wealth that we have. And that's something I really want to say that I'm very proud that Strong Cities has put it on the table. They're not running away from it.
Because I've talked to scholars, I've talked to
organizers. I've talked to people like Davon Love, you know, from Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle. I've talked to the police. I've talked to lots of people. And it seems to me that we have a gap in racial inequality. We have a gap in economic inequality. We have a gap in opportunity, equality. We also have a gap in compassion. And so when we talk about the difference between Barclay and Bolton Hill, one of the differences, it seems to me, is that the folks in Bolton Hill, who are generally speaking more affluent than the folks in Barclay, don't have a visceral reason to care about the people in Barclay. And it's almost everybody agrees that the only way that this thing really gets fixed is when people who have resources care in a fundamental way about the folks who don't. What is the argument to the people in Roland Park, the people in Guilford and in Homeland, to care about the Red Line not being built, to care about the job opportunities and the health disparities in Sandtown, Winchester? How do you make that case to them?
I would begin by saying that I think that challenge is a challenge for us as a country. We still live with our myths. We live with our myths as Americans in terms of Pew Charitable Trust just came out with a study that talked about 65% of this country still believes that everybody can make it by climbing up with their own bootstraps, when in fact 85% of the wealth is owned by very small. So that's a myth in this country. So we've really had to begin to dispel the myths about that, dispel the myths about the impact of structural racism, that what happened 40, 50, 60 years ago still has an impact now. But I think all that has to be part of the conversation with different communities that have more assets. But you also have to help them understand that their bottom line, their taxes, their bottom line in this city gets impacted by not paying attention. But you have to help them understand that people in those other communities, that they think those people are not broken. I say this all the time to people. First of all, that black and brown people are not broken, that systems and policies are broken, and they created that brokenness. So it really is a multi-level education to help people understand that their interconnectedness, our success as a city, relies upon can we change those outcomes. Yeah. And we have the power to do that.
Well, I do think that the institute that you're having on Saturday is going to go a long way to help fix whatever's broken. And I appreciate both of you all coming by and break a leg on Saturday. Enjoy it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Karen Stokes is the CEO of Strong City Baltimore. Diane Bell McCoy is the president and CEO of Associated Black Charities. Ms. McCoy will lead a panel on Saturday morning that kicks off the 9th Annual Neighborhood Institute. Panelists will include Peter Sabonis of the National Economic and Social Rights Initiative, David Hong from the Living Design Lab, and Heather Mazura, former member of the Maryland House of Delegates and candidate for governor in the 2014 Democratic primary. We've got a link to Strong City Baltimore's website with complete information about the Neighborhood Institute. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Coming up a little later, Sheila Cass talks to Dennis Ross, the former Middle East envoy, who will be speaking tomorrow night as part of the Baltimore Speaker Series. But first, we'll talk a little theater. Stay with us. In her weekly theater review today, Maryland Morning's J. Wynn Russick has found a play about movies.
Film is a series of photographs separated by split seconds of darkness. That's how an employee at a movie theater explains good old-fashioned celluloid film in the play The Flick. It's a description that also fits the structure of this 2014 Pulitzer Prize winner, receiving a poignant area premiere at Arlington's Signature Theater. Playwright Annie Baker has constructed The Flick as a series of mostly brief scenes separated by blackouts. More intriguingly, when we take our seats, we're facing several rows of movie seats. The projection booth is above and behind those seats. This means we are theoretically sitting behind the screen. If there were a movie playing, presumably we'd be in it. When the principal characters, three employees of this dilapidated movie house, look at the screen, they're looking at us, and we, of course, are looking at them. Designer James Kronzer's seedy set feels as real as the spilled popcorn the ushers are forever sweeping off the floor. But The Flick isn't just a slice of verisimilitude. It's an examination of what we truly value, of isolation and friendship, the workplace and the class system, and, on the most basic level, the difference between right and wrong. That's a lot of thematic heft, even for a play that runs more than 3 hours. But playwright Baker adroitly works depth into this seemingly mundane drama. And you're always fully engaged in the uncertain futures of the flick's three struggling small-town employees. In solid dramatic tradition, the action revolves around a newcomer who upsets the order of things. The play begins on Avery's first day, as Sam, the employee with the most seniority, shows him the ropes. Thaddeus McCants portrays Avery as initially terrified, as well as disgusted by the cleanup tasks the ushers perform between showings. McCants overdoes the anxiety of this character, who turns out to be practically a film savant. Avery's a fierce advocate of celluloid over digital. He's memorized Pulp Fiction, and he's adamant that there hasn't been a great American movie since. Or so he insists to co-worker Sam, played by Evan Casey as the soul of all that is ordinary.
Avatar! Avatar was a great movie made in the last 10 years. What? Okay, if you think that, like, if you actually think that, I can't even continue to have this conversation. If you actually think that, I need to, like, quit this job.
Avatar is a great movie.
As this exchange suggests, Avery doesn't quite fit in. He's especially uncomfortable with certain financial arrangements Sam has made with the projectionist, a green-haired, nose-pierced young woman named Rose. Laura C. Harris's Rose is a would-be free spirit with issues of her own. One of them, according to Avery, is that she's not a movie fan.
I never go to the movies. I'm kind of over movies. I used to be super into them, but now I'm over them.
Playwright Baker takes her time in the flick, as the pauses in Rose's speech suggest. Everything on stage takes its time, but Baker's script and Joe Colarco's knowing direction never flag. As we learn about these characters, we also learn about a society in which self-sufficiency takes on Darwinian proportions, and new technology is almost always valued over old. With amusing irony, Annie Baker conveys this in a highly theatrical play about a medium, film, that cynics once feared would replace live theater. Avery may believe the quality of American movies has declined in the last decade. The flick is a recent indication that the same cannot be said of theater.
The flick is at the Signature Theater in Arlington, Virginia through the 24th of April. Maryland Morning theater critic J. Wynn Russick reviews plays for us every Monday morning here on Maryland Morning. Next week, Judy will give us her take on Hunting and Gathering at the Rep Stage in Columbia. Coming up after a break for the news, Ambassador and former Middle East envoy Dennis Ross speaks with WIPR's Sheila Cast. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
Do you have thoughts on that segment you just heard? Email us at mdmorning@wypr.org or find us on Twitter. We're at Maryland Morning. Now back to the show.
It's Maryland Morning on WIPR. I'm Tom Hall. The current season of the Baltimore Speakers Series, presented by Stevenson University, concludes tomorrow night with a presentation by Ambassador Dennis Ross. He is currently serving as counselor at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy and a professor in the practice of diplomacy at Georgetown University. He was President Bill Clinton's Middle East envoy, and he served in senior positions in the Reagan, George H.W. Bush, and Obama administrations. His most recent book is Doomed to Succeed, the U.S.-Israel Relationship from Truman to Obama. He'll speak tomorrow night at the Meyerhoff. WIPR's midday host Sheila Cast will moderate that event. Sheila spoke with Ambassador Ross late last month.
Ambassador Ross, welcome to Maryland Morning.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
You are probably best known as a Middle East envoy, but you've also held top jobs focused on the Soviet Union and America's relations around the world. In your view, what is the biggest threat facing the United States today?
Well, probably the most immediate threat we face is related to ISIS, simply because ISIS is not just operating from an area in Syria and Iraq, but they're using that space, that operational space, to send terrorists out worldwide, but specifically to Europe. One of those who was arrested by the French described what was going on in Syria as being a terrorist factory, meaning literally like you're producing small dolls, they're producing terrorists. And I think we have to realize that that's probably the most immediate threat we face today. And there's, you know, the nuclear security summit that is the fourth that President Obama organized obviously has a relevance here, because you need to secure the safety of nuclear materials lest a group like ISIS, which is training terrorists, somehow gets its hands on materials. They may not be able to produce a nuclear weapon, but they could produce something like a dirty bomb, and that's really a nightmare scenario.
So in your view, what should the U.S. do about ISIS?
Well, I think we have to focus on how we set it back, but also how we do it in a way that discredits it. Those in ISIS claim to have a divine mandate, so the more they're seen as losing, the harder it is for their narrative to gain strength and gain a kind of appeal. They have used the image that they have this divine mandate, and they represent a pure form of Islam as a way of attracting many younger people who obviously are somehow on the outskirts or outside of society, who feel frustrated, who are looking for some cause to give purpose to their lives. And here is ISIS, which is slick on social media and seems to have this powerful message and a pathway to offering you a kind of purity as well. So the more you can discredit their message, the more you can discredit who they are, the more you're able to succeed. Now, ultimately, we won't succeed unless we have Sunni partners. We need Sunni governments, Sunni tribes, not only because of what they can do on the ground, not only because you need someone to replace ISIS when you set them back, but ultimately we can't discredit a message that is claiming to have a divine mandate and to offer purification of Islam. Only Sunni Muslims, who they claim to speak for, can be the ones to truly discredit them. So we have to be able to set them back on the ground. We also have to have Sunni partners who can replace them. We also need Sunni partners who can basically say they're not real Muslims. They're perverting the Muslim faith, and they represent, therefore, a threat to the Muslim faith. No non-Muslim can do that, and certainly we're going to need Sunni partners in that process.
That's Ambassador Dennis Ross, former Middle East envoy, here on Maryland Morning on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. He'll be speaking tomorrow night in the Baltimore Speaker Series presented by Stevenson University. You served in the Obama administration, but since you left, you have criticized the president sharply for what you see as inaction by the U.S. in Syria that created a vacuum the Russians stepped into. Now that the Russians are withdrawing their troops from Syria, how do things look to you?
Well, what's happened is there is this cessation of hostilities agreement, which is generally working. It's not working exactly the way it was designed to work, meaning A, there's still a level of violence, but it's down. B, there were supposed to be 18 different cities that had been cut off that were supposed to be open for humanitarian assistance. Many of them are receiving humanitarian assistance, but not all, and many of those that are receiving humanitarian assistance are still finding the Syrian military to pull medicines out of the convoys going in. So the situation is better than it was, just because the level of suffering is down somewhat. But let's take a step back and look at what Syria is today. Syria basically is a humanitarian catastrophe. It had a population of about 21 million before this war began. Now there are close to 12 million people displaced. Probably 500,000 have been killed. We see a terrible refugee crisis as a result. We see destabilizing of the region. We see a threat to the cohesion of Europe because of the refugee crisis. And the cessation of hostilities understanding, which, as I said, is not perfect but is better than what existed, offers very little prospect of a political agreement, because what you're seeing is Assad, because of the Russian intervention, has been cemented in his power, is much more confident now, knows he's going to survive, and shows not the slightest interest in any kind of real political transition. So I think where we are in Russia, where we are in Syria today, is a lessened degree of violence, which I hope holds, but I'm not confident will hold, a political process that is unlikely to be translated into anything meaningful, because the Syrian regime under Assad isn't prepared to accept a transition, and probably a kind of frozen conflict. I mean, I think we're going to see a partition of Syria in reality, even if it isn't sort of politically or legitimately acknowledged as such. And I think this conflict isn't going to go away. I think its overall level of violence may be reduced for a period of time, but I don't think we should count on this being something that's going to hold unless the Russians decide that they're really going to exert real leverage on Assad. And at this point, I don't see a lot of evidence of that.
Let me pick up on that. We just have a minute or so left. You wrote an op-ed in the Los Angeles Times a couple of months ago, headlined, "What Vladimir Putin is Really Up to in Syria." What do you think he's really up to now?
Well, I think he's always had in mind the value of demonstrating that Russia is a superpower again. He wants to show that he restored Russian pride, national pride. He wants to show that he's a power broker in the Middle East and elsewhere. He wants to be the arbiter of any kind of outcome in Syria while preserving a Russian position there. And he's in many ways achieved what he wanted in Syria, which is secure Assad to make it clear that the Russian side is winning, make clear that no outcome in Syria is possible without the Russians, in a sense, blessing it or defining it, make clear to the region that if you want to deal with security concerns in this region, the address is Moscow, it's not Washington. And he didn't need to help Assad take over all of Syria again, which he won't. But he needed to be able to secure Assad in power, and that he has done. So the real question for him is, over time, is he prepared to do more? And I think he is prepared, but only on Russian terms.
Lots to talk about. See you tomorrow night.
Great.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Ambassador Dennis Ross will speak tomorrow night at 8 o'clock at the Joseph Meyerhoff Symphony Hall as part of the Baltimore Speakers Series presented by Stevenson University. WIPR's Sheila Cast is the moderator of the Speakers Series. She spoke with Ambassador Ross 2 weeks ago. That's it for this edition of Maryland Morning. We'll be back Wednesday for Nathan Sterner and the entire Maryland Morning team. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks so much for joining us. Have a great day.